The young captain spoke quietly with one of the sentries on the forward firing step, and the man whispered a reply and pointed with his chin along the darkened trench. "This way, sir." He went on down the boards, swaddled in clothing so that he had the shape of a bear, and Sean towered head and shoulders above him as he followed. Around the next revert, through the soft curtains of falling snow, there was the subdued red glow of a brazier from the shallow dugout in the side of the trench. Dark figures squatted close about it, like witches at a sabbat. "Sergeant MacDonald?" One of the figures rose and stepped forward. "That's me." There was a cocky, self-assured tone to the reply. "Is Anders with you?" "Present and correct," said MacDonald. And one of the other figures rose from the circle about the brazier and came forward. He was taller, but moved with grace, like an athlete or a dancer. "You are ready, Anders?" the captain went on, speaking in the soft half-whisper of the trenches. And MacDonald replied for him. "The lad is fighting fit, sir." He spoke with the proprietary tone of the manager of a prize fighter. It was clear that the boy was his property, and that ownership gave him a distinction he would never have achieved on his own. At that moment, another flare burst high overhead, a brilliant white and silent explosion of light softened by the snow. Sean could judge a man like he could a horse. He could pick the rotten ones, or the big-hearted, from the herd. It was a trick of experience, and some deeper, inexplicable insight. In the light of the flare, his eyes flickered across the face of the older sergeant. MacDonald had the bony, undernourished features of the slum dweller, the eyes too close set, the lips narrow and twisted downwards at the corners. There was nothing to interest Sean there. And he looked at the other man. The eyes were a pale golden brown, set wide, with the serene gaze of a poet or a man who had lived in the open country of long-distant horizons. The lids were held wide open, so that they did not overlap the iris, leaving a clear glimpse of the clean white about the cornea, so that it floated free like a full moon. Sean had seen it only a few times before, and the effect was almost hypnotic, of such direct and searching candour that it seemed to reach deep into Sean's own soul. After the first impact of those eyes, other impressions crowded in. The first was of the man's extreme youth. He was nearer 17 than 20, Sean judged, and then saw immediately how finely drawn the boy was. Despite the serenity of his gaze, he was stretched out tight and hard, racked up with strain close to the snapping point. Sean had seen it so often in the past 4 years. They had found this child's special talent and exploited it ruthlessly, all of them. Caithness at 3rd Battalion, the Ferity MacDonald, Charles, Dickie, and by association, himself. They had worked him mercilessly, sending him out time and again. The boy held a steaming tin mug of coffee in one hand, and the wrist that protruded from the sleeve of his coat was skeletal and speckled with angry red bites of body lice. The neck was too long and thin for the head it supported, and the cheeks were hollow, the eye sockets sunken. "This is General Courtney," said the captain. And as the light of the flare died, Sean saw the eyes shine suddenly with a new light and heard the boy's breath catch with awe. "Hello, Anders. I've heard a lot about you." "And I've heard about you, sir." The transparent tones of hero worship irritated Sean. The boy would have heard all the stories, of course. The regiment boasted of him, and every new recruit heard the tales. There was nothing he could do to prevent them circulating. "It's a great honour to meet you, sir." The boy tripped on the words, stuttering a little. Another sign of the terrible strain he was under. Yet the words were completely sincere. The legendary Sean Courtney, the man who had made £5 million on the goldfields of the Witwatersrand and lost every penny of it in a morning at a single coup of fortune. Sean Courtney, who had chased the Boer General Leroux across half of southern Africa and caught him at last after a terrible hand-to-hand fight. The soldier who had held Bambata's ravaging Zulu impis at the gorge and then driven them on to the waiting Maxims, who had planned with his erstwhile enemy Leroux and helped build the Charter of Union, which united the four independent states of southern Africa into a single mighty whole, who had built another vast personal fortune in land and cattle and timber, who had given up his position in Louis Botha's cabinet and at the head of the Natal Legislative Council to bring the regiment out to France. It was natural the boy's eyes should shine that way, and his tongue trip. But still it annoyed Sean. At 59 I'm too old to play the hero now, he thought wryly, and the flare went down, plunging them back into the darkness. If there's another mug of that coffee, said Sean, it's bloody cold tonight. Sean accepted the chipped enamel mug and hunkered down close to the brazier, cupped the mug between his hands, blowing on the steaming liquid and sipping noisily, and after a moment the others followed his example hesitantly. It was strange to be squatting like old mates with a general, and the silence was profound. You from Zululand? Sean asked the boy suddenly. His ear had picked up the accent, and without waiting for a reply, went on in the Zulu tongue. Philapiwena, where are you from? The Zulu language came naturally and easily to Mark's lips, though he had not spoken it for 2 years. From the north, beyond Ishawi, on the Umfolozi River. Yes, I know it well. I've hunted there. Sean changed back to English. Anders. I knew another Anders. He rode transport from Delagoa Bay back in 89. John? Yeah, that's it. Old Johnny Anders. Any relation? Your father? My grandfather. My father's dead. My grandfather has land on the Umfolozi. That's where I live. The boy was relaxing now. In the brazier glow, Sean thought he saw the lines of strain around his mouth ironing out. I didn't think you'd know poor folk like us, sir. Fergus MacDonald spoke with cutting edge in his voice, leaning forward towards the brazier with his head turned towards him, so that Sean could see the bitter line of his mouth. Sean nodded slowly. MacDonald was one of them, then. One of those who were intent on the New Order. Trade unions and Karl Marx. Bolsheviks who threw bombs and called themselves comrades. Irrelevantly, he noticed for the first time that MacDonald had ginger hair and big golden freckles on the backs of his hands. He turned back to Mark Anders. He taught you to shoot? Yes, sir. The lad grinned for the first time, warmed by the memory. He gave me my first rifle, a Martini Henry, that blew a cloud of gun smoke like a bushfire that would throw dead true at 150 yards. I've hunted elephant with it. A great rifle, Sean agreed. And suddenly, across an age difference of 40 years, they were friends. Perhaps, for Sean, the recent death of that other bright young man, Nick van der Heever, had left an aching gap in his life, for now he felt a flood of paternal protection for the youngster. Fergus MacDonald seemed to sense it also, for he cut in like a jealous woman. You best be getting ready now, lad. The smile was gone from Mark's lips. The eyes were too calm, and he nodded his thin neck stiffly. Fergus MacDonald fussed over the lad, and once again Sean was reminded of a trainer preparing his fighter in the dressing room. He stripped off the heavy, voluminous greatcoat and the battle-dress jacket. Over the long, woolen, full-length underwear went a woolen shirt and two knitted jerseys, a woolen scarf around the throat. Then a mechanic's boiler suit, which covered the layers of clothing in a single neat skin that would not snag or flutter in a breeze to draw an enemy eye. A woolen balaclava over the head, and a leather airman's helmet. And Sean saw the reason. The British steel helmet had a distinctive brim, and anyway was no protection from a Mauser bullet. Keep your nut down, Mark, my boy. Knitted mittens with fingers cut out, and then thick, loose gloves over them. Keep the old fingers working, lad. Don't let them stiffen up on you. A small leather shoulder bag that slung comfortably under the left armpit. Ham sandwiches with plenty of mustard, chocolate and barley sugar. Just the way you like it. Don't forget to eat. Keep you warm. 4 full clips of .303 cartridges. 3 slipped into the thigh pockets of the boiler suit, and 1 into the special pocket sewn into the forearm of the left sleeve. I waxed each round myself, Fergus announced, mainly for the benefit of the listening general. They'll slide in like... And the simile was crude and obscene, meant to show Fergus's scorn of rank and class. But Sean let it pass easily. He was too interested in the preparations for the hunt. "I won't show Cuthbert until the sun is right." "Cuthbert?" Sean asked, and Fergus chuckled and indicated a third figure that lay quietly at the back of the dugout. It was the first time Sean had noticed him, and Fergus chuckled again at his puzzled expression and reached out to the reclining figure. Only then Sean realized it was a dummy. But in the light of the brazier, the features were realistic, and the helmeted head rode at a natural angle on the shoulders. The model ended abruptly at the hips, and below it there was only a broom handle. "I'd like to know how you're going to do it," Sean addressed the question to young Mark Anders. But Fergus replied importantly, "Yesterday the Hun was shooting from low on the northern slope of the hill. Mark and me worked out the angles of the two shots he made, and we've got him pegged to within 50 yards."
"Well, he may change position," Sean pointed out.
"He'll not leave the north slope. It's in shadow all day, even if the sun comes out. He'll want to shoot from shade into light." Sean nodded at the logic of it.
"Yes," he agreed. "But he may shoot from a stand in the German line."
And Mark answered quietly, I don't think so, sir. The lines are too far apart here. The German line ran across the crest of the hill. He'd want a shorter range. No, sir, he's shooting from close in. He makes a stand in no man's land, probably changes it every day. But each time he comes close, so that he can get to our lines while still staying in the shadow. The boy had not tripped on a single word, now that his mind had locked onto the problem. His voice was low and intense. I picked out a good stand for the lad, just beyond the farmhouse. He can cover the whole of the northern slope at less than 200 yards. He'll move out now and settle in while it's still dark. I'm sending him out early. I wanted to make his move before the Hun. I don't want the lad walking on top of the bastard in the dark.
Fergus MacDonald took over from Mark with an air of authority.
And then we both wait until the light is good and clean, and then I start working with Cuthbert here.
He patted the dummy and chuckled again.
It's damn difficult to give him a nice natural look, like some stupid rookie sticking his head up to take a first look at France. If you let the Hun get too long a look at him, then he'll tumble for the trick. But if you make it too quick, he won't get a chance for a shot. No, it's not easy.
Yes, I should imagine, Sean murmured wryly. I should imagine that it's the most dangerous and difficult part of the whole thing. And he saw the deadly expression flit across Fergus MacDonald's face before he turned to Mark Anders.
Another mug of coffee, lad, and then it's time to be getting on. I want you in place before the snow stops.
Sean reached into the breast of his greatcoat and brought out the silver flask that Ruth had given him on the day that the regiment sailed.
Put some fangs in the coffee,
he offered the flask to Mark. The boy shook his head shyly.
No, thank you, sir.
Makes me see squiff.
Don't mind if I do, sir,
Fergus MacDonald reached swiftly across the brazier. The clear brown liquid glugged freely into his own mug. The sergeant major had sent out a patrol before midnight to cut a lane through the wire in front of A Company. Mark stood at the foot of the trench ladder and changed his rifle from the right hand. Another flare burst overhead, and in its light Sean saw how intent the boy was on his task. He pulled back the bolt of the rifle, and Sean noted that he was not using the standard No. 1 short Lee Enfield, which was the workhorse of the British Army, but that he favoured the American P-14, which also fired the .303 calibre, but had the longer barrel and the finer balance. Mark stripped 2 clips of ammunition into the magazine and closed the bolt, levering a round of carefully selected and waxed ammunition into the breech. In the last light of the flare, he looked across at Sean and nodded slightly. The flare died, and in the darkness that followed, Sean heard the quick, light steps on the wooden ladder. He wanted to call good luck after the boy, but suppressed the whim and instead patted his pockets for his cheroot case.
"Shall we get on back, sir?" the captain asked quietly.
"Off with you,"
growled Sean, his voice gruff with the premonition of coming tragedy. "I'll stay on a while."
Though he could give no help, somehow it seemed like deserting the boy to leave now.